Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, Talk About Adoption and Infertility. I'm Dawn Davenport, the director of Creating a Family. We're a nonprofit providing education, resources, and support for adoption and infertility. You can find us at creatingafamily.org. The Creating a Family radio show is supported by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Ferring is proud to introduce their new Heart Plus Pharmacy Savings Card, which helps patients, both cash-paying and insured, save money on their fertility meds. You can get more information about the Heart Plus Pharmacy Savings Card from your doctor or from the Ferring website, which is ferringfertility.com/heart. Or, of course, you can call them at 1-888-FERRING. You can get more details on their Heart Plus Pharmacy Savings Card. I blog weekly on subjects usually relevant to adoption or infertility, and we have had the most fascinating discussion in the past several days on my Friday blog, which was my response to Dear Abby's screwy response to a woman questioning the appropriateness of her friend having an adoption fundraiser. We are now at 80 comments, ranging from adoptive parents and adult adoptees, and it's just been absolutely fascinating. If you haven't been involved, you are truly missing something. And today's blog is titled Second Best or Second Choice, Adopting After Infertility, and it touches on the issues of how to explain to your child that you tried for many years to have a biological child before adopting her. Please share your thoughts on either of these blogs at creatingafamily.org/blog. And why not connect with me over on the social networks? We talk about all sorts of topics relevant to adoption or infertility, and you can reach me on Twitter at DawnDavenport1. On Facebook, I'm Dawn.Davenport1, and you can join the Creating a Family Facebook support group. The easiest way to find it is to type in Creating a Family in the Facebook search box. This group is a really active and fun place to connect with others on the same journey you are on. We upload a video a couple of times a month. A video you may find helpful is Evaluating Health Risks in a Potential Birth Mother Match for Domestic Adoption. You can find this video on our adoption video page at creatingafamily.org, or you can access it through our Creating a Family channel on YouTube. It is the largest adoption channel and infertility channel on YouTube. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not happen without the generous support from all of our sponsors, including Nightlight Christian Adoption, pioneers of the first embryo adoption program called Snowflakes. They started that in 1997. Over 260 babies have been born with the assistance of the Snowflake Embryo Adoption Program. We also have Suzanne B. Nichols. She is an adoption and reproductive law attorney with offices in New York and New Jersey with over 30 years' experience helping create families. And if you are trying to choose an adoption agency or an adoption attorney or looking for an infertility clinic or doctor or a surrogacy or donor agency, we now have a searchable database to help you select just the right one for you. You can search by location or number of adoptions per year or services provided or a host of other criteria that we think are important when choosing. These are agencies and professionals who have chosen to support us. And their support allows us to continue to bring you this show and all of our resources. And if you've benefited from any of our resources, we hope that you will support those who do support us. And now I have a brief advocacy request. The Family Act of 2011, which is a proposed Senate bill, is having an informational session today, and we are trying to get out all of the senators to attend. You can get more information. What we're asking for you to do, by the way, is contact your senators and ask for them to have someone from their office attend this informational meeting and or, not or, but and, support this Family Act bill. You can get more information on our Infertility in the News page, which is under our Infertility Resources on our site. So please do that for us. Now, today's show is on adopting U.S. children abroad. How do U.S. families living abroad adopt a baby from the United States or adopt internationally while living outside of this country? And also, is it possible for non-Americans to adopt a child from America? Please join our guests, adoption attorneys, Jim Thompson, or actually James Fletcher Thompson. They're turns out to be quite a few Jim Thompsons, so he goes by James Fletcher Thompson, with offices in Spartanburg and Charleston, South Carolina. And we also have Irene Steffes. She has an office in Atlanta, Georgia, but serves clients throughout the world. Jim has been practicing adoption law for over 22 years, and Irene has been practicing adoption law for 27 years. So we truly have a wonderful expertise to help us explore this today. Welcome, Jim and Irene, to Creating a Family.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to be here, Dawn. Thank you.
Well, we've purposely made the topic for today's show fairly broad to allow us to take full advantage of having two of the preeminent attorneys with knowledge in the area of cross-border adoptions from and to the United States. So the outline briefly that we're going to follow today is first to talk about issues involving U.S. couples living abroad who want to adopt either domestically or internationally. And then we're going to move to talking about foreign families adopting U.S. children. And then last, we'll touch on the issues for foreign nationals living in the U.S., adopting either U.S. children or trying to adopt children from their own country or any other country and bringing them back to the United States. So lots of territory to cover, but I'm very optimistic that we'll get to it all. Let me start with this question from Roland. He's a really good introduction to our first topic. He says, my wife and I teach in international schools. We currently live in Germany, but have lived in a number of countries and move about every 4 to 5 years. We plan on this being our careers and want to continue doing this until we retire. We are both in our mid-30s now. We do not have a home in the United States, but we do go back to visit family once a year for about a month. We are beginning to think about adoption. Thank you, Dawn, and Creating a Family, for being with us and providing invaluable resources for this long journey to reach this point. We are open to both domestic adoption or international adoption, but don't know if we will have problems with either of them since we don't actually live in the United States. We are both U.S. citizens and were born and live in the United States and lived in the United States until our mid-20s. All right, now, Jim, let me start with you, and then, Irene, please jump in. This opens up the whole bailiwick of what issues should Roland and his wife expect. Let's start by saying they're open to either domestic or international adoption. Let's start with domestic adoption. How can a U.S. citizen living abroad, in this case in Germany, adopt a child who is born and living in the United States or will be born in the United States?
Okay. Let's lay just a little bit of groundwork first about the Hague Convention. Do you think that's something that your listeners are generally familiar with, Dawn?
Well, we certainly talk about it a fair amount. However,
yeah.
I think we had best talk about it again, especially for this show.
Well, I think so. The answer is very different if we were answering this 3 years ago before the United States in April of 2008 signed and joined the Hague Convention on Intercountry Adoptions. Now that we have, the rules have changed. Irene and I are one of three attorneys who are have gone through the approval process as allowed by the Department of State, and there are, Irene, I'm thinking maybe 16 agencies or so that are also accredited to do what we call outgoing cases. In short, we have incoming cases, which are adoptions from other countries into the United States. We have outgoing cases, which is what our email sounds like, which is children in the United States being placed into other countries. And so that's the term of outgoing. If there is a Hague country who is going to be the receiving country, such as Germany, there's an adoption between a Hague country and the United States, those are two Hague countries, and so we have to look at the Hague issues. So now specifically, the question is, Can Roland mm-hmm. and his wife adopt here? And aren't you glad you have two lawyers? But the answer is maybe.
Let me guess. Wait, let me guess.
It depends. The bottom line is the Hague does not look at issues about necessarily where you live. There's a term of art that it uses, which is habitual residency. So if, for instance, a person is a habitual resident of the United States, adopting a child from the United States, it is not a Hague case. The question now comes down to, is Roland a habitual resident of Germany, or can he be considered to be a habitual resident of the United States.
Now, let me ask you a question here.
Sure.
Now, clearly, well, I shouldn't say clearly, but I, from this question, it certainly seems like Roland and his wife are traveling on a U.S. passport. They have a U.S. citizenship. So why apparently habitual residency depends on more than what passport you cover or what you carry?
That's true.
Basically, it's the country. I interrupted you. I'm sorry, Irene. Go ahead.
No, I have an analogy that I use in explaining this problem because it really is quite complex. And if you were to look at the U.S. regulations, the U.S. regulations will say U.S. citizens living abroad, if they're planning to return to the United States prior to the child's 18th birthday, they are and they wish to adopt a child from within the United States, we consider that a domestic adoption. However, that's not where the discussion ends. And it took me a really long time to figure this out and make sense of it. And the best analogy that I've come up with is if you were to consider a coin standing on its edge, heads would be the United States, tails would be the other country. So if, as you look at Roland's question, from the perspective of the United States, this would be considered simply a convention, a domestic adoption that's not touched by The Hague. However, as you mentioned, this child is going to be traveling on a U.S. passport with his or her parents in Germany and down the road maybe to Dubai or North Africa. How did those countries consider the child? Because a child needs a visa. Having a passport isn't enough to get you into Germany as a dependent. So for Roland's case, immediately we would look at what does Germany say? What does Germany require in order to get the child a visa with the parents to come to Germany? And in some countries, it requires The Hague, and in other countries, it does not. So how's
Germany,
that for a definitive answer?
Well, so Germany might, I mean, down the line, say they move to Dubai, why would they even have a clue as to how that child joined the family? You know, that may be 6 years down the road. You know, would they even at some point question how did this child has the same name as his parents? How would they even know that the child was adopted?
Because they asked that question on the visa applications. And I can tell you this has been a big problem for U.S. citizens who perhaps are dual citizens with another country. We saw this early on with the Philippines, where a person, adoptive parents, were citizens of the Philippines and citizens of the United States. And the Philippines said just what the United States did, says, this is a domestic adoption. So they would go to the Philippines, adopt a child, and then they would want to bring the child back to the U.S., and the U.S. would say, no, 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 you can't come back to the U.S. until you do the Hague dance. So you have to consider both perspectives. And from the perspective of the U.S., how is anybody going to know? There's a questionnaire, and if a U.S. citizen says, oh, I had this baby while we were living in Germany, the U.S. family should anticipate a request for DNA testing.
We touched on this. We just did a show 2 weeks ago on exactly the issue of surrogacy abroad, and we had somebody from the State Department on, and I'm just mentioning that was on July 20th, so any of our listeners, July 20, 2011, any time you have a child born abroad, for the most part, they do it case by case, but you should expect to have to prove a DNA connection. Just wanted to point that out. Well, this may not matter, but it seems to me if Roland and his wife said, okay, you know what, if it's going to simplify our life, we could come and take a one-year assignment in the United States. We don't know, but we'll. Yeah, why don't we just say we'll plan on that before Junior reaches 18? Would that change anything if they were able to say, sure, you know, yeah, we'll do that? Even if they end up not doing it, you know, would that change anything? And Jim, I'll start with you, and Irene, jump in.
Well, it would clearly be a domestic adoption if the child were born born here and they were residing here, because that, because the issue about whether they're habitual residents, they can even intend to return to the U.S. by the child's 18th birthday and for the United States purposes be considered habitual residents of the U.S. So, yes, that could be done, and then they would just go through the normal process if they ever wanted to travel abroad again. But the other,
well, I mean, let's say they're still living in Germany, and they just say, okay, if it's going to make our life easier, we will plan before junior here reaches, you know, a junior to be reaches 18. We'll plan. We'll, you know, we'll tell the United States that we'll come back and reside in the United States.
It's that's just not necessary, because what they could also do is simply do a Hague adoption, where they go through the process remaining there in Germany. And now, again, sometimes that's for whatever reason. Maybe they've identified an adoption in the U.S., and maybe that situation would not be meet the requirements of Hague. But when a family could choose to do a domestic adoption non-Hague, meaning non-convention, that's another term for it that we use, or they could go ahead and, as Irene says, dance the Hague dance. A lot of families that I'm working with choose to go ahead and dance that dance, jump those hoops, so that down the road, in situations that they presently can't even anticipate, there would be, you know, advantageous to them to have completed a Hague compliant adoption.
Okay, so now let's go ahead and Irene, you've introduced our dance here. Can you explain the steps to the Hague dance?
Well, they're numerous and they're expensive, and that's why, you know, at the onset we talked about, is this a Hague Convention case or not, is because we're talking about over $10,000, and that is a significant consideration. So the point I would like to emphasize is, in making that determination of is it a convention adoption, you have to consider the laws of the United States and also the law where the family is residing. So, you know, look at both of those. Let's say we have an American family living abroad and they're going to do a Hague-compliant adoption. They will have to begin by doing a home study, which is very different in other countries than it is in the United States. And I'll talk about this as being a following the Hague rules, and Jim has a lot more experience than I do on outgoing cases, so I'm going to ask Jim to jump in as I go. But
okay.
There are only, generally speaking, there are home studies are going to be done by a government entity, like the government branch that's in charge of children's issues. And in some countries, there are independent adoption agencies that are accredited for international, but they will, you know, comply with that. And they will be approved by the receiving country.
The home study provider has to be approved. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
So they will have their home study. They will be approved. And then the central authority of that country, of the receiving country, let's say Germany, will say, okay, Roland and his wife have been approved, they may adopt, and they will send their home study to a U.S. Accredited provider, primary provider. So the oftentimes the families never even see their home studies, but what's critical is that home study goes from a government entity overseas directly to a U.S. primary provider.
And
it has to be
someone who was approved or has already been going through the Hague accreditation process. And so in the United States right now, if it's an outgoing case, there are only, I think, 16 agencies and three individuals have that accreditation.
Okay, so if you're living, am I correct here, if you're living abroad, a U.S. citizen, and you are going to have to complete an adoption that complies with the Hague, you will need to work with either one of the three attorneys or the approximately 16 adoption agencies. Okay, and where would somebody get a list of the approved agencies? And we know two of the approved attorneys, James Fletcher Thompson and Irene Steffes. So we know you two, but where would a list be kept of this information?
The third is Michael Goldstein from New York, and then these other agencies are listed on the State Department's website.
Okay.
Which is adoption.state.gov. So if you go to that website, adoption.state.gov, and then go to the Hague portion of that website, it's very easy to navigate, and you'll come to the where all the accredited agencies and approved persons and accredited entities are listed, and they will clearly say incoming, outgoing, or incoming and outgoing.
Okay, so that's how for those of you who are listening when you're trying to figure out how to do this. Well, the what I had understood was that one of the impacts of the U.S. becoming a member of the Hague Treaty was that the emphasis on Hague throughout the world is that you try to place children within your country first. And if that's not possible, only then do you seek a family outside the country. So the expectation was originally that it would be very difficult to place U.S. children, particularly those not in foster care, and we'll talk about foster care adoptions in a little bit, but outside the United States, because we certainly have a large number of families looking to adopt, in fact, more families looking to adopt than we have children to adopt in the United States. So, Jim, how is that playing out? It seems like as long as
Sure.
we have more families, then there should be no children going abroad.
I think it's true that we have more families in the U.S. seeking to adopt children in the U.S. than there are children to adopt, but that's only of certain children. And there are other children, look at the Department of Social or the Abuse and Neglect, if you will, the foster care system, where there are children that are languishing in foster care drift for years after year. And the same is true in private adoption, that there are children that we do not have families prepared to adopt. Those may be children that are historically more difficult to place, that may be children with special needs or older children. Historically, children of color were more difficult to adopt within domestic private adoption. The numbers may be true that there are many people in the U.S., but not for any particular child. And so I'll give you an example. For years, if I have, a special needs child or an African-American little boy, I may only have one or two families to show, meaning a family profile to show to an expectant mother or a woman who's already given birth and is choosing an adoption plan for her child. And frankly, birth moms today, thankfully, are very empowered in that decision, and they want to consider a lot of other choices than maybe the one or two that we would historically be able to offer. So now through the Hague process, we have families from Canada or the UK or Holland or wherever it may be who are interested in adopting U.S. kids. We can show those profiles, and the birth mom has the chance to be able to have scores of families to choose from, thereby feeling more connected. So let me get back to this issue of reasonable efforts you asked. How is it we can do that? Well, the United States regulations have interpreted that birth mother preference, the selection of the adopting parents by the birth mother, is in itself sufficient basis by which that reasonable efforts is satisfied. So if a birth mom selects a family based on whatever her specific, unique, individualistic criteria is, and that family happens to be from British Columbia, Canada, that coupled with a finding by a state family court judge that that's in the child's best interest not to be, if you will, warehoused for 60 days while in foster care while they look for a U.S. family. If a judge makes that finding that it's better for the child to move directly to that family, that satisfies the Hague's reasonable efforts requirement.
And Irene, are you finding that is almost guaranteed that a judge will approve that if the birth mother selects a family that is living or either is living abroad or is a foreign national?
Yes, that's not a problem. I like to see a few additional safeguards. I like to show the court that the birth mother has indeed received counseling and understands all of her options. I like to show the court that she has been shown not just international families, but domestic families as well, and also that the playing field is level. We haven't offered the birth mother anything extra or a bonus, if you will, by selecting a family from out of the United States. So the mechanisms and the safeguards that are in place right now, I think, are very good. We are not seeing a huge exodus of children leaving the U.S. The numbers, as best we can tell, are still under a couple of hundred per year. There are people who are questioning those numbers and saying, oh, that they know that more children are leaving. But I don't know if they're including cases that were grandfathered in before April 1st, 2008. So that might be why there's a little bit of a discrepancy. But the numbers are really quite small for children leaving the U.S.
The numbers were probably pretty large, Dawn, in 2009, because as Irene says, the grandfathered cases, or if you will, the transition cases, where people had already made application that did not flow under the Hague, even though it was after April 2008. We're now getting into where most of those families have already been worked through, and now the placements that are being made are true Hague cases.
From a practical standpoint, do you find that American birth mothers are less likely to choose a family, either an American family or a non-American family living abroad? Jim, I'll ask that one to you.
No, I'm not. I think the world seems to have shrunk so much where birth mothers, in their empowerment, there are a lot of international adoptive parents who are also more receptive to openness. And again, I'm from South Carolina, a traditionally closed adoption state, where there might be some mediated contact between birth parents and adopting parents, but not an open model. Birth moms are being able to look at, let's say, a Canadian prospective adoptive family, where in Canada, adoption education and training emphasizes more openness. So not only would it be that the family they might connect with, but they also might choose another locale that is more eclectic or diverse than where that might be a U.S. family or a South Carolina family. So the question of openness, question of diversity, question of the life you want to give a child is unique to each birth mom, and I have not found that someone living abroad is an impediment to that at all.
Irene, what about you in your practice?
I agree. It's all about making a connection. A birth mother will select a couple because of some very subtle reason that might not be apparent to you or me, but that she automatically connects with this family. It might have to do with their love of music. It may have to do with their love of the ocean. It might have to do with a name. The birth mother may be of French heritage, and she might be very inclined to select a family that is living in a French country. So it's not an impediment, but we're not seeing huge numbers either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Irene, let me ask you this question. For a domestic adoption, the adoption has to be finalized in some state court. And if you don't have a U.S. address, do all states allow you to finalize in the state where the baby is born? Or if the child is going abroad, is the adoption finalization some type of different process?
It can be a different process. For example, the state of Georgia only permits residents who have lived here for more than 6 months to file a petition for adoption and finalize their case. So in Georgia, we would not be able to finalize the adoption here. In fact, what we would get from Georgia would be termination of parental rights. We would also get a form of guardianship and custody, which would give the family permission to return to their home country, and then once in their home country, they would finalize the adoption there.
And that would apply for even if there are U.S. citizens, in this case, Roland and his wife, in Germany, that
Correct.
They would finalize the adoption in Germany because that's where they reside?
That's correct. Now, U.S. military, they have a great deal of flexibility. U.S. military, they have the option of choosing a state as their U.S. domicile. And therefore, if they were residing in Germany but had chosen Georgia as their domicile, we would be able to finalize their adoption in the state of Georgia.
I'm glad you raised military families because that was a question I wanted to ask. We did get a question about is there anything specific to military families and who, as we know, might well be stationed abroad and adopting? Okay, you've mentioned that the military allows families to choose a U.S. domicile. By doing that, does that preclude the need for doing any form of complying with any of the Hague? In other words, does that then become an automatic, if you're in the military, a non-Hague adoption?
No. Again, go back to the coin, look at the head and the tail. From the perspective of the United States, this is a domestic adoption. But you want to take the child with you back to Germany. So what does Germany say? And I believe anecdotally, I was speaking with a friend who said, child going back to Germany to live on a U.S. military base, Germany was saying this is a Hague Convention adoption. So every case, we have to do the analysis from both sides of the coin.
So in that case, if Germany says for this child to come back with you, a U.S. military personnel living on the base, we are still going to treat this as, for the purposes of receiving a visa, we're still going to treat this as a Hague Convention, which means you will need to comply with the Hague.
That's correct.
And the main disadvantage, is, it sounds to me, is a bit of a hassle, but perhaps more. Well, a hassle, I suppose, is one thing. Cost is another. And the third would be perhaps a lower options of being selected because you've got to comply with the reasonable efforts or be able to show that you comply with reasonable efforts to find a U.S. family, or is that really not that much of an issue?
I wouldn't consider that to be an issue. What I would see as the number one deterrent is the time it's going to take. You know, in the United States, we're spoiled. You can have a home study completed in 4 to 8 weeks. With all the background checks done. If you want a home study done in the United Kingdom, you're looking at 12 months. So, you know, it's just a much different process when you're looking at the laws of the other country. And I know I'm making this sound really awful, like the other countries have, difficult laws. To be realistic with everyone, the United States, in my opinion, has the greatest number of regulations, the greatest number of hoops to jump. But when you're beginning a case, it's imperative to look at both sides of the coin.
Okay, that makes good sense.
Dawn, another part about these different states, state by state, you know, we look about requirements of being able to finalize an adoption is different in Georgia and South Carolina, for instance. Anyone can adopt a child if the child is present in the state of South Carolina at the time of filing with no residency requirements. That's sort of night and day, and we're sister states. So not only are we looking at the country where you'll be adopting and where you will be living, but also you're breaking this out by state-by-state laws. And one of the other laws in that way is a Hague requirement about no contact. And this is one of the impediments of adopting an a Hague adoption versus a traditional domestic adoption. You know, the Hague set out some regulations that are applying uniformly, even in places and times when it's probably not necessary. For instance, if we were adopting a child in Central America, and before the Hague, we've heard horror stories about the exchange of money to birth parents prior to signing a consent in an effort to induce them to do so. And, of course, the Hague Convention looked at that and said we should have the observance of a no-contact rule so that there's no contact mm-hmm. between the birth parent and the adoptive parents prior to the execution of those documents. Well, same thing is true in outgoing adoptions under the Hague in the U.S.
Which is so weird because in the United States, many places, birth mothers' requests are, and quite frankly, are being actively encouraged to meet prospective adoptive parents before choosing. So it flies
totally
in the face. Yeah,
it does. And there's felony, you know, criminal prosecutions for such things. So there's plenty of enforcement without that no contact rule. Thankfully, these regulations under the Hague Convention have been interpreted to allow face-to-face contact between birth parents and adopting parents prior to the execution of a consent document if the state, meaning Georgia, South Carolina, California, has a statute or a practice that allows that face-to-face contact prior. So, for instance, in South Carolina, we actually have a case that allows the selection of the adoptive parents and therefore, you know, contact, face-to-face meetings with the families prior. Well, then now our State Department will interpret that to mean, yes, it is not a violation of the no-contact rule because we have a specific state law that allows that. Some states don't have such statutes. And so a family from Germany adopted in the U.S. May only be able to have contact with their birth mother and maybe phone contact or face-to-face contact or be in the hospital delivery room if they are in a state that has a statute that allows contact.
Well, and it has to be a statute because I don't know of any state that prohibits contact.
Exactly.
But you're saying, I mean, just the fact that they don't prohibit it, they actually have to have a statute that specifically allows it?
Well, no, because there are a lot of statutes that imply it. For instance, in South Carolina, we have a statute that says you can have understandings and agreements about post-adoption contact, but that contact is not enforceable. Well, mm-hmm. that statute, by very implication, when do you have that conversation? You can't have an agreement if you didn't have contact prior to the execution of the consent.
Okay.
Therefore, you can have a statute that recognizes that implied by that statute or the routine practice of the state is to allow birth parents and adoptive parents to communicate. You may point to regulations and adoption agencies that allow that have been approved by the state regulatory authority. So it has some color of law that allows that contact that is sufficient under Hague to be able to resolve the observance of the no-contact rule.
Well, one of the big issues under Hague is the prohibition of any money changing hands between the adoptive parents or their attorney or their agency and the prospective birth mother, and yet many states in the United States allow some forms of birth mother expenses, and some are fairly generous, quite frankly. And the adoptive parents, in some cases, adoption agencies actually are the ones who pay it, but in many cases, the adoptive parents are the one, even if they pay it through their attorney. Irene, is this prohibited under The Hague for outgoing cases, even where it's allowed?
No, it is not. What you have to look at is the actual state law, and the foreign countries will defer to the United States. So if the United States, the specific state, let's just say the state of Florida, says that you are permitted to pay for food, clothing, shelter, and transportation, then the United Kingdom will say, well, if the state law permits it and it's lawful, we will accept it. So there's, you look at every case from both sides, and then you have to look at the law of the specific state, and then you also come into dialogue with the local authority that you're working with overseas. For example, when we were talking about contact, you're not supposed to have contact prior to the match. So initially, a birth mother may be shown a profile of prospective adoptive parents. She cannot, though, speak to them on the phone until a child study has been sent to the local authority in the UK. The local authority sits down and for the first time says, this birth mother has selected you. You have 2 weeks to decide, and goes over the child profile with the birth mother. With the adoptive parents, I'm sorry. And then if we get green lights from the local authority in the UK that, yes, we will, this match is good, we will accept this match, then you can permit contact. So there are a lot of variables, and I have, to be very honest with you, I have not found two to be exactly the same.
Well, but many times a birth mother or an expectant woman will choose to not make a match until she has spoken with the prospective adoptive parents. So what happens then?
Well, it's a good question. We have a family who is considering an outgoing case, and they know very clearly that they're prohibited in having a direct telephone call with the birth mother. So what they chose to do is they did a videotape of the husband and wife in their home, and they're talking, and they're saying, gee, we wish we could pick up the phone and speak to you, but we have to jump through these hoops, and we have to wait until our authority gives us permission to do so. We hope that this videotape will suffice in the meantime.
Okay, and that's, and then that, you know, that, I think at this point, you're explaining on the other end to the expectant woman that this is, you know, if she thinks she wants this couple, she can always, I suppose, after the match is made and she meets them, she could always change
right.
her mind, I suppose. So
yes, gets, yes.
All right, now we've talked about, oh, go ahead, Jim.
I was going to say, you know, these family profiles that people put together, you know, they can really be a window into the souls of who these adoptive parents are, and if they're done well, that's exactly what they are. And and a birth mom, you know, I've seen her, you know, go over, you know, 10 and 15 of this and just laboriously work through reading each of those letters and looking at each of those pictures. And my experience is that is often enough for her to feel at peace about the decision she's making.
And I should also mention at this point that we have extensive resources. We've a huge section of our site we just added about a couple of months ago on how to find prospective birth mothers or expectant women, and including extensive resources on preparing adoptive parent profiles. And I liked your term, a peek into the soul, because I think that is, if when done well, they do show you the essence of the family. Now, we've talked about both U.S. citizens abroad as well as foreigners abroad. I guess that's somewhat redundant to say, isn't it? Anyway, adopting children. But let's. I do want to talk briefly about foreign nationals living in the United States and wanting to adopt, either domestically or internationally. So, first of all, let me ask, is it possible for a foreign national living in the United States to adopt domestically? Jim?
Yes. But once again, it goes back to the issue of which country, their country of origin, and how they're going to interpret the other side of that coin, which is that domestic adoption can be done if all the requirements are met. But, you know, is this going to be the need for a Hague adoption? And I think what Irene said at the very beginning of our conversation is true. Part of this is each case is so different that there's a preliminary stage. And this is why some of the cost is involved, where none of these answers can be given uniformly across the board without going back and looking at the specific facts and, most importantly here, what country they hail from.
Yeah, that makes it, if nothing else that we are gaining from this conversation, it's how idiosyncratic and how individual every one of these cases will have to be. And unfortunately, all of that adds complexity, which adds, unfortunately, cost. So this may be a stupid question, but what citizenship would the child have? Born here in the U.S., so clearly would have U.S. citizenship, I would guess, but yet adopted by parents who are citizens of another country, and it would seem weird for the parents to have a citizenship that the child doesn't have. So, Irene, what citizenship would this child likely end up with? Irene? Oops, I think we're having
trouble. I'm sorry. I forgot I had put it on mute.
Okay.
it will depend on the country. The United States is very generous with citizenships. We don't mind if you are a dual citizen. So let's just say that the child that the family is adopting is going to be going at some point in the future, maybe 10 years from now, back to the UK, the child would be able to get a UK passport or an EU passport. But to start with, a child is a U.S. citizen. And really, when we've seen this on the flip side for children coming into the U.S., it's extremely common, I would say 99.9% of the time, that when the child first arrives to the United States, they're entering with a citizenship and a passport from a different country. And only after they get here do they get to change and get their U.S. passport. So the same thing is going to be true. Their child will probably end up as a dual citizen.
And if the other country allows dual citizenship?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this begs the question that I should have asked before we moved on to this, and that is, how would a U.S. citizen living abroad, let's say Roland and his wife, how would they adopt internationally? Let's say they want to adopt a child from China. Walk us through, Jim, what the issue is. How would you think through that issue?
Let me punt to Irene because she has so much more international experience on that.
Let's talk about anybody, but let's use Roland's as an example.
Sure.
He and his wife decide they want to adopt, pick a country, let's say China,
okay,
which happens to
okay
be a hate country.
Yeah. Let's do China because I have several cases right now from China and they are not simple to figure out. Number one, Roland would be utilizing the services of a primary provider in the U.S. that has a program in China. So he would be looking for a U.S. accredited agency with a Chinese program. Jim and I don't have programs in China. We're not looking to open up programs in China. So we would step back. But there are, I would say, a good dozen or so agencies with such programs.
Mm-hmm.
That agency, which is located in the United States, is going to have a contract with a social worker that will be licensed in Germany to do home studies. And that worker will conduct the home study for Roland and his wife according to the U.S. Hague standards. And then the paperwork will all go under the umbrella of this U.S. accredited agency. The U.S. accredited agency will then, at the appropriate time, file the dossier with the Chinese authorities. The Chinese authorities will make the match. Roland and his wife will go to China and adopt the child. And now what? What happens at that point is the child will need some type of a visa to go back to Germany. If possible, after they get their adoption, their Hague adoption certificate, the family could immediately file for U.S. citizenship. because the child is not, the family does not reside in the United States. So the child doesn't get a visa to come in. The child can go straight through citizenship. And what we're doing is we're asking for all of the paperwork to show that the case was approved and to get the adoption certificate from the U.S. consul in Guangzhou, and then file the N-600K, and then the child is a U.S. citizen. That answers it from this side of the, I guess, Pacific or Atlantic. The question is, what will Germany do? The convention itself says if an adoption has been completed by two convention countries, a third convention country should will recognize that adoption.
Well,
however,
go ahead.
If it's the U.S., let's say a Canadian couple goes to China, adopts in China, and comes back, we're trying to resolve what kind of a visa that Canadian couple will have to bring their child, their Chinese child, into the U.S. if they're residing in the U.S. It's, you have to look at the jurisdiction of both Germany, U.S., and China.
I'm really glad I didn't try to answer that question.
Yeah, nice way to punt there, Jim.
I did well on that.
Yeah. You really did. So you're saying that it's not the child who is the child, is clearly the child by Chinese law and U.S. law, the child
right.
of U.S. citizens. But yet going back into Germany, let's say they came to the United States first,
mm-hmm.
the child on there before they went back to Germany, showed the kid off to the grandparents, came back. By entering the United States, the child then acquires U.S. citizenship. The child then they stay here long enough to get a U.S. passport. They
right.
are then going back to Germany or Canada or wherever they are living. That child might be viewed differently than if the child had been born to them?
Yes. And the best way to explain that is if we flip the countries. If we, and you know, what you brought out is a very important point, and it's counterintuitive because we all think, well, gee, I've adopted this child. This child is mine. This child should get immigration status to the United States. And no, the child doesn't automatically get immigration status. There are a whole lot of hoops to jump through and very specific procedure to follow. So let me
just
show
irritating you. Because we think of adoption as being the same as, and you can't see me, but I was making air quotes around that, but that legally the child, once the adoption is complete, that child is legally yours with the same rights as a child born to you, but that apparently isn't going to be enough.
That's for immigration law.
For immigration,
it's
yeah.
not. And
it's
I will
true,
say
it's true of the coin, the head of the coin, not the tails.
Yeah. Well, poo. That's not nice.
And the United States has the most difficult and most rigorous regulations of all. So it may not be so difficult. But let me just show you the flip side of this.
Okay.
Let's say we have a Canadian couple living in the U.S. They go to China. They do a Hague Convention adoption between Canada and China. Can they bring that child into the U.S.? Not easily.
Well, now, see, I would assume that if the child had a Canadian passport at that point, the child had gone back with their family to Canada, why would they not be able to come? Because they're not trying to gain U.S. citizenship. They're just trying to reside with their parents here in the United States. No citizenship is being incurred.
Correct. But they need a visa to come in.
So it's only if the visa is required that would be probably, and that's the visa is required because they're going to be here for a longer period other than a term.
Right. They're going to be here more than 6 months.
Right.
I can give you an example. My employee, Jodica, is currently residing in Sevilla, Spain. and she works for me full-time via Skype. We have numerous conversations per day, and we have wonderful staff meetings with her sitting at the table on the face of a laptop.
Don't you love technology?
Love Skype. She was able to get work authorization in Spain in a half a day. In the United States, we are talking about months, if not years.
Yeah.
So we're quite, it's very difficult in the United States to get a visa for a child to come to the U.S. But we're working through this, and the part that I see as being optimistic is we are still, the United States, when I say we, is working under interim regulations. The final regs have yet to be published. So I'm hoping that there will be some latitude in the final regulations.
That will, address some of these issues. Well, in the short time we have left, I have more questions that we've received that I cannot get out. But let me try to get a few of these. Foreign nationals living in the United States, can they go back? This is a question I'm going to cut up. Can they go back to their home country, adopt a child there, and bring that child back into the United States? I'm going to guess that this question needs to go to Irene.
Unfortunately, yes. they can go back home. They can adopt their child from Canada. And only after they've lived with the child for 2 years can they bring the child into the U.S. as with a green card. So it's problematic.
Even if they don't, what if they don't have a green card? Well, one of my questions that I was going to ask is, does it matter if they are in the process of getting a green card? Is it any easier if they are just here on a visa but not a green card?
I'm working on that issue right now. I have two cases exactly with that issue. So to be continued.
Yeah, to be. So we don't know the answer to that. But
correct.
If they have a green card, they have to then go back to their home country, live with the child for 2 years before they could bring the child into the United States.
That's correct.
Wow, that is interesting. But adopting, so then would it be easier? Would it be fair to say that it would be easier for foreign nationals living in the United States to adopt from the United States than to adopt from their home country?
Yes.
Isn't that interesting? Now, if the if the foreign national living in the United States wants to adopt from another country, let's go back and use our China example. Let's say they want to adopt from China. Walk me in the last minute we have here, Irene, can you walk me through what they would need to do?
That's the issue that I'm currently researching for two Canadian families who are in the process of adopting children from China. I'm trying to see if there's a way to bring that child in.
Gotcha. And it would be simplistic then to say that they would then have to comply with the adoption laws of their country. In this case, the example you just gave was Canada.
Yes.
It would be true that they would have to comply with the adoption law, the international adoption laws of Canada. But the issue, the crux of the issue that you don't know that you're researching now is how to get that child then back into the United States with them.
That's correct.
Well, that is absolutely depressingly fascinating.
Well, I'll let me show you what's really, in my opinion, the greatest hardship of all.
Okay.
Is what if you just wanted to adopt your niece or your nephew, and the parents died in a car accident last month?
Oh, yeah.
You have to go through the entire Hague process. That child is not permitted to come into the United States on a temporary basis, and it is a very lengthy, expensive, and arduous process.
And that lengthy and arduous process is not ameliorated in any way by going back to your home country for a short period of time.
That's correct.
Wow. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. And I'm almost speechless because I did not, I thought as an attorney for one, but also as somebody who spends their life working with adoption issues, this is far more complex. And I am so thankful that we had James Fletcher Thompson, and otherwise known as Jim, and Irene Steffes for our guest today on Creating a Family. To get more information on James Fletcher Thompson, you can go to one of two sites. His actual site is adoptionsc.com, but to get more information on him and his practice, another place to go is adoptionattorneys.org, which is the website for the American Academy of Adoption Attorneys, which we reference on our How to Choose an Adoption Attorney page. You can get more information on Irene Steffes and her practice. You can go to her website, which is Steffes Law, steffaslaw.com. This show will be archived on the 2011 Big List of the radio page of creatingafamily.org. It's also available for download as a podcast from iTunes. The easiest way to find it on iTunes is to use the iTunes button on our radio page. To stay in touch with the latest developments in adoption or infertility, as well as receive the upcoming week's blog and show topic, sign up for our weekly newsletter at creatingafamily.org. Next week's show, August 11th, will be on creating attachment with adopted kids in the first year. The UN estimates that there are 143 million orphans in the world, including 115,000 currently available for adoption in the U.S. foster care system. These kids, as well as the millions of older kids throughout the world, deserve a home. To get more information about U.S. children waiting for a family, go to the adoption resource page of creatingafamily.org, where we include links to various photo listings of some of these kids. Thanks for joining us today, and I will see you next week.